Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
We all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with co-host Jake Towne. Gene DiNardo is going to be joining us shortly here on this Thursday, March the 10th of 2011, and a lot of interesting news to be going over today, a lot of headlines that we'll be wanting to touch on, including one I want to get in right now, Jake, because my UConn Huskies beat, with Kemba Walker at the buzzer, beat number one Pittsburgh at the Big East tournament today. Hooray!
Hey, that's almost as important as the Charlie Sheen news.
That's right. Hey, don't knock UConn Huskies, man. They're important. But let's get on to the more serious news of the day, and the biggest news is coming out of Libya with news that Colonel Gaddafi's tanks are striking deeper into the rebel heartland. Jake, you have the details on that. Give them to him.
Right. It continues to be a very interesting story unfolding in the country of Libya, still between pretty much a civil war between Muammar Gaddafi and the rebel forces. And it's been interesting to see this overplay over the media, since both sides have really been trying to leverage the media into seeing things one way or the other, to see the rebels as the winners and what have you. But out of the chaos, what was reported today by Reuters Africa is that the city of Ras Lanouf, Libya tanks were firing on the rebel positions in this oil port. War planes hit another oil hub further east as Gaddafi continued to carry out counterattacks deeper into the insurgent heartland. State television said in late afternoon that the army had driven the rebels out of Ras Lanouf. The insurgents have denied this, but said that government forces are heavily bombarding it and thrusting well into the Mediterranean coast town. The rebels took an important step towards international legitimacy when the country of France recognized their national council. But while NATO and the EU discussed what measures they might take, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence forecast that a well-equipped Gaddafi would prevail over the rebels in the end. Again, he has an air force. The insurgents do not appear to have that. They also do not appear to have a whole lot of tanks and the most modern weaponry. The insurgents have also reported an airstrike on Brega, which is another oil port 90 kilometers east of Ras Lanouf, which is in the opposite direction of the capital city of Tripoli. And according to the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, he was at a U.S. Senate hearing today and quoted that Gaddafi is hunkering down, showing no inclination of ceding power, and that we believe Gaddafi is in this for the long haul. And he also speculates that Gaddafi would be able to win mainly due to better equipment and better and more organized logistics in the long term. So very, very crazy time as things are still unfolding. I think the financial markets are going to see a very interesting day tomorrow. Brent crude is still trading a little bit shy of $114 a barrel. The West Texas Intermediate is about $104 a barrel as we speak.
So lots of stuff, a lot of unhappy going on in Libya. By the way, Jake, did you see the story about the BBC team that was detained? Very interesting one. It was reported in a number of locations, but this is by the BBC's Wire Davies reporting from Tripoli. He says in his report, officially we are allowed to travel around the country freely and to see what we want. The Libyan Information Ministry has even written to the United Nations to that effect, promising that free passage would be guaranteed to all reporters wishing to cover the crisis. But the reality is very different, he writes. Reporters are routinely stopped from going out beyond the confines of central Tripoli. The official government media trips are of limited use from a news-gathering perspective, and those on such trips often come across so-called spontaneous demonstrations by fanatical pro-Gaddafi loyalists. Now, there were two BBC teams on Monday trying to get to Zawiya, the provincial town about 30 miles west of Tripoli, which is under rebel control. Now, the official government line has been that its troops were taking up heavy defense positions and there had been minimal loss of life and no heavy fighting. But the reporter writes, we knew the truth was different. Some enterprising journalists had already managed to get in past the many roadblocks and reported the terrible conditions inside Zawiya, and we wanted to see for ourselves. My small team was in a car, he wrote, a couple of kilometers behind Chris Ferris and Gott I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, in the other car. They initially seemed to be having more luck than us. We had been stopped by a polite but insistent army officer who detained us at a checkpoint on the outskirts of Tripoli for the best part of 4 hours before sending us back to our hotel, frustrated but otherwise unharmed. All along, we had been in touch by phone with the other team, who had managed to progress a couple of kilometers further than us on the road to Zawiya, but they had tube and pulled over to the side of the road and rang us to say they weren't allowed to go any further. Apart from a couple of snatched, frantic phone calls, it would be the last we heard from them for 21 hours. Toward the end of the week, they ended up sitting in the same hotel room in Tripoli, relieved but well aware of how badly it could have ended. Now, here's what happened. Let's see if I can skip down a little bit. Among the three members, Faris is a tough and experienced reporter for the BBC Arabic service. He's a Palestinian with a Syrian passport, and he seemed to be singled out by the people who stopped them for the worst of the violence that was inflicted on them. And wait till you hear what the violence was. He says, Goetke was, by his own admission, the one most convinced during their interrogation abuse that they were going to be killed. The cameraman simply couldn't see a way out, not after the way the soldiers had beaten Faris with their fists, knees, and rifles. Above the loud music, this is when they were in the prison after being taken in, I could hear Faris in agony. We could hear screams. Our taxi driver, who was with us, was praying, terrified and saying that we were all going to die. Another of our colleagues managed to get a call out to the BBC saying we were in trouble. That colleague, who had managed to conceal his phone, was Chris, a tall but quiet-spoken man who has traveled the world and seen a lot in his time with the BBC, as have all of this hugely experienced team. But even he, on occasion, during his ordeal at the hands of the Libyan army and secret police, thought that perhaps his time had come. They had already gone through a mock execution, hooded and thrown to the floor off the back of a jeep, while armed men repeatedly cocked their guns just feet away. Hours later, when it happened again, Chris feared the worst. He said, we were lined up against the wall. I was the last in line, facing the wall. I looked up and I saw a plainclothes guy with a small submachine gun. He put it to everyone's neck. I saw him and he screamed at me, said Chris as he went over things. Then he walked up to me, put the gun to my neck and pulled the trigger twice. The bullets whisked past my ear. The soldiers just laughed. Fortunately, now it just feels like a bad dream. Bad dream, perhaps, writes the reporter, but now well away from Libya, it will take the guys some time to get over their experiences at the hand of the Libyan military. Above all, they worry about the screams and cries of their fellow detainees, Libyans, many from the town of Zawiya itself. Chris, Goetke, and Faris are in no doubt that many young Libyan men were being subjected to far worse and more prolonged maltreatment than they had to suffer. What has become of them? They have no organization like the BBC to lobby for their release or the luxury of British passports to afford them some protection. So as Goetke told me before he boarded his plane out of Tripoli, they are probably dead.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's a very chaotic experience going on there, probably on both sides.
Chaotic, and quite clearly, Colonel Gaddafi has not given up his old tricks. He's continuing to engage in abusive treatment of people, torture, all kinds of horrible treatment happening within his prison walls. And, of course, we won't find out about this later on, but it will be interesting to see once everything is finally settled, once the civil war is finally over one way or another. It'll be interesting to see what the International Court has to say in terms of crimes against humanity.
Right, and that's one of the other things that, in retrospect, might not have been the smartest, in my opinion, because what you saw very shortly after this whole thing began, the International Court stated that they would seek. One fellow stated that he would seek Gaddafi for war crimes and crimes against humanity for the things that he had done in the first few days of the conflict. And I don't know, this is just my opinion, but I think that might have, if there was any inclination of him actually giving up and peacefully handing over the reins or what have you, it probably just convinced them that he's probably better off fighting to the death, as it were.
That's quite possible, and unfortunately we'll have to wait to see how all that plays out. Meanwhile, the unrest that has spread across the Middle East is now working its way into Saudi Arabia, and I know you have some details about that.
Right. Today, the police fired on protesters in the town of Al-Qatif in the eastern city along the eastern seaboard in an effort to quell the escalating unrest in the kingdom. And one of the more interesting events that will be occurring tomorrow is something that they call the Day of Rage. They held one of these in Iraq, I believe, a couple weeks ago, where it was just a massive protest and people getting together. Bahrain has also seen these types of protests, And tomorrow there has been a demonstration called for where I think somewhere north of 30,000 people on Facebook are all linked together, 33,000 people. And there's lots of folks that are saying that this won't be occurring, or it might, but not too many people will show up. It's very, very unknown exactly what's going to happen because the main tool organizing this is all online. But what is pretty certain is that the regime in Saudi Arabia will react pretty violently. They've even been blatantly saying that that's exactly what they are going to do. The foreign minister said, quote, Saudi Arabia has prohibited demonstrations as it goes against the country's law, unquote. So, you know, here in the United States, you know, theoretically you have the right to assembly, and certainly it's not nearly as challenged as it is in a lot of these other countries. But it'll be very interesting to see how it goes, namely, of course, because of the whole oil-producing area and the effects. Today's crude market was fairly flat towards down throughout the day. And I think that a lot of people are just kind of waiting to see what's going to occur. And what's also quite interesting is the country of Bahrain, which is a small little isthmus hanging into the Persian Gulf, that we spoke about last week, has also had a lot of demonstrations. And it's interesting to see the whole politics that is breaking out, because Bahrain is very small, really only several million people, but it's very, very close to the Saudi Arabian border. And it'll be interesting to see how this goes, because, again, the government of Bahrain, it's a banking center. It's also the home of the United States Fifth Fleet. It's close ties to the United States. The majority of its population is Shia, but the government is Sunni and heavily linked to Saudi Arabia. And of course, the Shia majority, which is just a different branch of Islam, would be more linked to the Iranian side. So it's one test case for what's going on in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, to try and prevent what was going on in Tunisia and Egypt at the time, before this Libyan thing had all blown up, had given a package of like $36 or $37 billion in pretty much just straight welfare payments to try and keep quell dissent, but that continues, as obviously the people there don't really feel that they've been sharing in the economic success of the country, and only that a select few has been profiting at the expense of the many, which is kind of a common theme as we look at governments across the world. But so anyways, with Bahrain, it'll be interesting to see how everything plays out because of the massive instability. There's riots in Yemen. There was more riots in Iran. And also yesterday there was riots in the same square in Egypt, this time between Muslim and Christian protesters.
It seems like... I was under the impression that the people in Saudi Arabia were... better off than the other countries in the Middle East. Is that true or not, as far as poverty?
I can't claim to be an expert, but most of those countries in there, they do have a very well-off group that is in power. Like whatever group is in power will get all the government jobs, all the well-paying jobs, and that sort of thing, and have the connections in place. There's typically, like, if you take a look at Dubai, or probably also like Saudi Arabia, you also have usually a fairly large migrant population from countries such as like Bangladesh or India to mainly perform a lot of the brute force labor.
Right.
But there is a pretty large, I'm not sure if we could call it even a middle class, but a lot of those countries do have a group of people. I just see all the wealth, all this crazy wealth that the people that control the oil have gotten, and kind of want it for themselves. And I think that I can't really speak in Saudi Arabia, but at least in Egypt, you know, a lot of that protesting was really due to the belly. Like, people see all this inflation, and price increases, which we talk about the show all the time, is just really from the central banks printing up money. And, you know, it's more rioting from, you know, not having work and not having any way to put the food on the table for their families.
Yeah, so even if they're doing okay, you know, some countries they may be doing better than others, still there's such a disparity of wealth and poverty.
Right, and switching gears for a little bit, but if we take a look at Vietnam, I've been following a story that the Wall Street Journal's been putting up for the past week or so. And in Vietnam, this country has electricity and fuel price increases, concerns that are sending it possibly as much as 24% inflation in a year.
Wow.
Currently, the Vietnam is run still by a communist government. Has one of Asia's worst inflation problems with a consumer price index that hit a two-year high of 12.3%. That, again, is subject, just like here in the United States, to interpretation. So when you hear 12%, it's probably more or less to think of that's the absolute minimum, and it could easily be double or slightly more than double that current rate. And what's very interesting is that today in the Wall Street Journal, Vietnam, the government there has moved to ban the trading with U.S. dollars. So,
because they're so frightened about their own currency?
Well, what ends up happening, if you take a look at things such as, like for instance in Zimbabwe that had this hyperinflation going on, one of the alternatives that they had was to use the dollar, which, again, as we're aware, is constantly being inflated and losing value. In general, but compared to the Zimbabwe dollar, it was a heck of a lot more stable. So the people there began using that, and that's pretty much what ended the hyperinflation there. But what Vietnam is doing is, you know, the people on the black market are trying to find a way. You know, the gold imports into that country have really been off the map. In one way of trying to protect from the inflation of the government money printing. But here, what they're trying to do is just to stop people from transacting in dollars. So, in the short term, they predicted, in the short term, the Vietnamese stock market went up, and bankers said that they expected gold shop rates to continue to fall throughout the day as people sell the dollar. There's a lot of people are switching from savings from dollars in the gold into the Vietnamese dong funds. Since the police forces have announced they will arrest anyone who trades dollars outside the banking system and will confiscate those dollars. And then this is actually a straight quote from the Viet Com Bank, one of the national bank securities trader. This move has brought great benefits to the stock market, unquote. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all unfolds. Because in the short term, it might fix things for a few days or it might look good to those in power for a few days. But probably in the long term, you know, it's not hard to guess what's going to happen in Vietnam. They're going to keep printing. The inflation is probably going to get far worse. And now the people are going to be made into criminals for trying to transact in other currencies.
What a crime.
It very much is. And, in fact, along the same lines, there are similar crimes happening here in the United States. In fact, we've discussed a number of times here on the program allegations of silver manipulation by the major banks, and that story has reared its ugly head once again this past week, guys. Theodore Butler, who is a blogger and an investment counselor who spends a lot of time emphasizing the precious metals, put out an article on silverseek.com. It was posted on March 7th, in which he reiterated that once again J.P. Morgan is engaged in using silver future contracts to short the silver market and try to drive the price down. And the interesting thing that comes out of the particular information that he provides is that there is a report that comes out from the government every year called the Bank Participation Report. It's actually a relatively new report. It's only been coming out for the last few years. And in that report, they basically detail, well, they don't detail, but they provide summaries of how much of the various futures and options contracts are either short or long by the market as a whole and by the banks. So in other words, they break it down in terms of what the bank participation is as a group. And over time, the various people who watch this market closely have discerned that J.P. Morgan is the one who played the major role in and all the allegations of market fixing that have been going on. And, of course, the government and the Commodities and Trade Commission have been looking into it, or they claim they've been looking into it, but they've been very slow to act on it. This past week, the bank participation report came out, and there was a net increase in the U.S. bank category of 6,000 contracts to a total of 25,000 held net short against silver. Now, J.P. Morgan's net silver short position, which had decreased by 11,000 contracts over the preceding 3 months, it suddenly ballooned to 25,000. And from Mr. Butler's reading of the reports, he says, it appears that the big increase in silver short selling by JPM took place during the last COT reporting week. That's the way they divide up commodities reporting. He says, let's see, he goes over the details of what's happened over the last 2.5 years and how he had originally raised evidence talking about the manipulation of the market. And then he points out that the current buying of these short contracts has happened in the middle of a huge increase, a huge bull market in silver. And in fact, what it appears that these contracts are designed to do is to stop the bull market from advancing. So he actually calls in the article, he calls on the government to basically bring J.P. Morgan to the fore and say, hey, look, what are you doing here? Let's have a public statement and so forth and make clear, you know, why it is that you're taking these actions. Because if you look what happens to somebody who takes a short position in an advancing bull market, basically that's an automatic loss. It's a huge loss. And so the question becomes, well, why is J.P. Morgan doing it? The only possible reason to do it is to control the silver market.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. That article, I think, Silver Shocker is available at silverseek.com for anyone looking to read it and kind of learn a little bit more about this whole subject. But, yeah, the silver has continued in backwardation, really, for the past month. It was still in backwardation on the London Exchange, at least, this morning.
And, of course, backwardation is where the current silver being taken is being paid for at a higher price than future silver down the line, which is usually just the opposite of what it normally would be.
Right. And the total number of silver contracts is somewhere in the vicinity of 130,000 to 140,000 contracts currently.
Which is amazing. In fact, one of the things that Butler pointed out in his article is that the total short position, I believe it exceeds the entire annual production of all but the three largest silver mines for a year.
Oh. Yeah, no, there's
that's the scale of the manipulation that's going on.
You said there's the total is 140,000 and J.P. Morgan had 26,000 of those?
Right. Well, the 6,000 contracts, the new contracts represented 30 million ounces of silver, which is really one of it's an entire annual production of a major, and there's not very many silver producers.
Jeez.
And this also, like we said, this has been an ongoing thing. Last year, around the same time, there were similar allegations going on. In fact, there was actually a bit of whistleblowing that went on when a particular unnamed trader made some comments about how J.P. Morgan was basically controlling over 85% of the commercial net short positions in silver futures. And there was a lot of speculation about who that might be. Eventually, it turned out that the informant was identified as Andrew McGuire, an independent precious metals trader in London. On January 26, 2010, McGuire sent Bart Chilton, a member of the Futures Trading Commission, an email urging him to look into the silver trading that day. The email said it was a good example of how a single seller, when they hold such a concentrated position in the very small silver market, can instigate a sell-off at will. And on February 3rd, McGuire gave the Futures Trading Commission word about an impending manipulation event that he said would occur 2 days later when the Labor Department's non-farm payroll numbers would be released. He then spelled out two trading scenarios about which he had been told. Both scenarios will spell an attempt by the two main short holders, J.P. Morgan and HSBC, to illegally drive the market down and reap very large profits. That's what he wrote in an email to the Trading Commission. On February 5th, McGuire, in the words of this New York Times blog that I'm reading, took a victory lap, writing in another email to the Trading Commission that the silver manipulation was a great success and played out exactly the plan as predicted. And yet, here we are a year later, and still nothing has happened. He actually said that, yes. He actually predicted how it was going to happen. He laid out the scenario, told the regulators how it was going to happen. It happened the way he said, and they still haven't done anything.
Of course, right, I would think that's the direction the government would enjoy, you know. I mean, as far as protecting currency.
Well, it's just like, you know, for instance, like people look into the SEC or this Commodities Future Trading Commission, which is just another group of bureaucrats, and people have this myth that they're going to actually act on things. And, you know, in this case, this investigation has been going on for 2 years by the CFTC, and they haven't done anything. And, you know, take a case, I guess the last one that a lot of folks are probably aware of was the Bernie Madoff scandal. That was very blatantly, anyone that took a close look at the records would be able to find it out. But the SEC sure didn't blow the whistle on them. They even had memos by a trader, a competitor of Madoff, that figured out that everything he was doing was fraudulent. And he did all this research and turned it into the SEC on a silver platter, and still they did nothing until blew up.
I think I read they actually did a couple audits where they went in there and talked to them, and they just went home, said everything's okay.
Yeah, they probably took them out to dinner.
Yeah, they went to lunch.
Took them out to dinner with all the stolen money. But
yeah, who pays?
But actually, Gene, you raise an interesting point. Why didn't they follow? Because, like you would think, normally there would be an interest in the government doing that. But in this particular case, where silver manipulation is concerned, there's actually a government motivation to not investigate
it.
And that motivation is the same motivation as to why J.P. Morgan would be trying to manipulate the silver market. And there are also, of course, many allegations out there that they have tried to do the same thing with the gold market. Why would they try to manipulate silver and gold? Because they want to continue the illusion that there is not an inflation problem. Mm-hmm. Inflation almost always shows up first in commodities, particularly the precious metals. So if you keep the precious metals from flying out of sight, you basically lull everybody into believing that the inflation rate really only is about 1% to 2%. So there's the answer to your question, Gene. This could very well be part of an overall plan to continue to convince us that inflation is low.
Yeah. And actually, the way it's going, J.P. Morgan is almost an agency of the government.
Very true. Very true. And it's almost scary when you think about that, because supposedly it's a quasi-private organization, but
right.
In reality, we know that it's not.
No, it's connected directly to the Federal Reserve. So.
And, of course, it's also connected to what happened with the financial crisis, and we're still seeing the fallout from that. And I think you have a report for us about what's been going on with foreclosures and what the courts are doing.
Yeah, there was, I think last time it was about a month ago, there was some court decisions that actually were in favor of MERS, and of course, this is being dealt with by the states, so there's different decisions all over the country, but this has some basis in Oregon, but I'm going to read here, and it says, sales of hundreds of foreclosed homes in Oregon have been halted or withdrawn in recent weeks after federal judges repeatedly questioned their legality, according to a number of real estate attorneys in the state. Lenders have withdrawn more than 300 foreclosure sales since February in Deschutes County alone. And Deschutes County was the big boom county in Oregon. It's kind of a resort area, fast-growing area. And their values, I think, they doubled in a matter of a few years, and they've taken the biggest hit also. So in Deschutes County alone, one of Oregon's hardest hit by the housing collapse. About 130 of these notices were filed in the past week, attorneys say. Dozens of foreclosure listings by Recon Trust Company, the foreclosure arm of Bank of America Corporation, have disappeared from its website. A Bank of America spokeswoman said the bank was canceling certain sales to ensure that those homeowners had fully explored options to avoid foreclosure. And in a potential deal breaker for other foreclosure cases, one of the nation's largest title insurance companies is warning lenders that it might not guarantee title in some cases. Oregon was kind of behind in the foreclosure curve, as we usually are in booms and busts, but it says here that foreclosure sales in the state totaled 10,500 last year, or 28% of all home sales. Goes on to say the legal concerns revolve around mortgage electronic registration systems. That's MERS that we've been talking about. Virginia Corporation set up in the mid-90s by the mortgage banking industry to rapidly record the ownership of mortgages so they could be packaged and sold as security. MERS essentially allowed lenders to sell loans without recording each transaction with county recorder office. That rapid and sometimes reckless securitization of such loans contributed to the 2008 financial crisis and housing slump. The problems clouding the foreclosure process, including last year's robo-signing scandal that forced several big banks to suspend foreclosures in about two dozen states, continue to drag down the housing market today. Since October, federal judges in five Oregon cases have halted foreclosures involving MERS, saying its participation caused lenders to violate the state's reporting law. Three of those decisions came last month, the key one in the U.S. bankruptcy court in Eugene. So the Oregon, a lot of the Oregon courts are actually deciding against MERS, which goes against the, we were talking about it last time, and I can't remember where those cases were, but the court definitely decided the other way. Some suggest lenders might not have access to the documents they need to comply with state law. A lot of us are questioning whether there is a solution, said David Ambrose, who's a Portland attorney who represents lenders in mortgage transactions. It's pretty amazing. There are a lot of unanswered questions. MERS is listed as an agent for on more than 60 million home loans, about half of all home loans. Homeowners nationwide have challenged its standing. In New York last month, a federal bankruptcy judge ruled that MERS lacked authority to foreclose on homes it didn't own. Oregon is a state where lenders can foreclose without going to court, but state law also requires that the loans ownership history or assignments be recorded with local county governments. And this is where they're having the problems because of that requirement, which isn't a requirement in other states, believe it or not.
Absolutely.
You know, you can just walk in there, I'm going to foreclose on this guy. But Oregon law permits foreclosures without the benefit of a judicial proceeding only when the interest of the beneficiary, that's the lender, is clearly documented in a public record. When the public record is lacking, the foreclosure beneficiary must prove its interest in a judicial proceeding. Also last month, MERS told its member lenders in a memo distributed nationally to stop foreclosing in its name while it worked to address legal challenges. Now, that's huge because, like it said, 60 million mortgages are under the MERS name, and I don't know what the overall rate of foreclosure is right now, but whatever percentage it is, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do if they can't go that route. It's just it's a real quagmire, and then, you know, it's their own fault, to put it bluntly.
Well, I think we're going to have to explore that after the break because this is an important topic. So let's go to break, and we'll come back and talk about what's going on with the mortgage mess. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Adam Coulter with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com.
Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. This is Bert Cohen. My past shows include The New Media Power of Comcast, Socialism for Wall Street Only, and How to Empower Your Own Community Over Corporate Interests. For archives, go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and listen to The Bert Cohen Show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The Bert Cohen Show. There's really nothing like it.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No. Don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Allison Rosalie D. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
We're back here on the Freedom News Hour talking about the mortgage mess and how it's been playing out since 2008. After Gene's story about MERS, I think it's time we also go to a story Jake has about what's happening with the number of people with underwater mortgages. Jake, what are the details on that?
Sure. A couple of days ago, an article came out by the Associated Press that the number of underwater mortgages are rising as more and more homeowners are falling behind. About 11.1 million households, or 23% of all mortgage homes, were underwater in the October-December 2010 quarter, according to a report released Tuesday by the group, the housing data firm CoreLogic. That's up from 22.5% in the July-September quarter of last year. The number of underwater mortgages had fallen in the previous three quarters, but unfortunately that was due to more homes falling into foreclosure.
Not a good thing.
The roughly two-thirds of homeowners in Nevada with a mortgage have negative home equity, which probably includes the Las Vegas metropolitan area, which is the worst in the country. Arizona, Florida, Michigan, and California are next, with up to 50% of homeowners with mortgages underwater. Oklahoma had the smallest number at 5.8%, and only nine states recorded percentages less than 10%. So it's just another indicator that really things aren't going all that well. The article also states that another 2.4 million homeowners are getting very close to the point where they will be underwater as well. And again, for our listeners, when a mortgage is underwater, what that means is the homeowner often can't qualify to refinance the mortgage, and they have little recourse but to continue making payments in hopes that the property will eventually gain its value. The other option, of course, is the homeowner can just walk away.
And of course, more specifically, it means that they owe more on the house than the house is literally worth within the current real estate market.
Correct.
The other thing that was kind of incredible, I think, about that article was that they mentioned that that was just mortgaged homes. I mean, if you had bought, of course, mortgaged homes are probably the majority of homes, but if you bought cash, if you bought a house for $200,000, it's now worth $125,000. It's not included in the statistics.
That's a good point. I mean, you're right. Most homes are mortgaged. Boy, I can't talk straight. Most homes are mortgaged, and most real estate is mortgaged. But there are some people who do buy with cash, and it would be interesting to see just how much hurt, shall we say, has been applied to those whose homes basically lost money without it actually showing up in the mortgage crisis.
Yeah, who actually, you know, saved up the cash, didn't want to deal with a mortgage, and the cash
or perhaps paid off their mortgage over time, paid off early, something along that line.
Yeah,
the amount of damage is really underestimated, I would say, given even what we do know already about how the mortgage crisis has played out.
And to imagine that percentage, 23% of people are paying. And, you know, the first five, even for a 30-year loan, the first 5 or 10 years is almost all interest. And they're paying, you know, to the bank for money it's basically rent, like I think you mentioned a couple weeks ago. You're basically paying rent.
think that's, well, that's certainly the way the unemployment people like to track, or not unemployment, the inflation people. They like to assume that all people are essentially rent payers rather than mortgage or house buyers.
Oh,
and so that when it comes to calculating inflation, that's the only way you actually calculate based on the monthly payments. So I guess that means if the entire population goes from 30-year mortgages to 50-year mortgages and lowers their payments, therefore inflation actually turns into deflation.
Yep. That's what we should do.
Figure that one out. Oh, my goodness. It's a crazy world, folks. What can I say? Well, I know that Jake has another article that he's been dying to get to. he keeps chatting to me. We've got to go over this one because we just talked about it earlier. So, Jake, give us the details of what's going on with President Karzai over in Afghanistan.
Well, yeah, Gene had a story that he wanted to go over first, really, on...
Sorry, you're right, you wanted to bring that up. I'm doing it backwards,
helicopter?
So that's my fault. But go ahead, Jake, why don't you do your story anyway, and then we'll do the other one.
Sure. Today, what was reported by the BBC is that NATO has killed the cousin of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. This relative was mistakenly killed by NATO troops in southern Afghanistan. It is reported that Yar Muhammad Khan was at his home in the Dan district near Kandahar when he was shot dead in an overnight raid. NATO, their usual, says that they're investigating the incident, and Hamid Karzai, also the usual, says that this is bad.
Very bad.
Yeah,
don't
no
shoot
kidding.
My cousin.
Oh, my goodness. And what's the other side of what's been going on between Karzai and General Petraeus, Gene? I know you have a story about that.
Well, that was the tragedy that occurred with the killing of 9 boys by the, I believe it was a NATO helicopter. And the U.S. commander apologized in person to the leadership of the government Sunday for the mistaken killings of 9 children in the Kunar province Tuesday. But the Afghan president rejected the apology, according to the statement from the president's spokesman. Petraeus attended the Afghan National Security Council Sunday, and he explained that the shootings of the boys who were 9 to 15 years old was a mistake and apologized to the Afghan people. In response, Karzai said the apology was insufficient. Civilian casualties worsen the relationship between Afghanistan and the United States, he said. And the people of Afghanistan are tired of these incidents, and excuses and condemnations cannot relieve their pain, Karzai said. I am asking you on behalf of the people of Afghanistan that there be no repetition of this incident. It says, it goes on to say that far more civilians are killed by the insurgents than by NATO, but the any deaths by the civilians by NATO are taken very, very badly. It's part of there's quite a bit of resentment. You know, they view the United States as a invading country in a sense. The shootings occurred in a poor mountainous area. A couple of the boys who died were the only males in their families and were responsible for the care of their mothers and sisters. The loss of the only male in Afghanistan means that the women will have to rely on relatives. They don't have any kind of welfare net like we do, and who are usually are already overburdened with their own families.
Right, and from reading a lot of these reports, like the Civic report put out, what should be done and should be the common practice is that the force doing the killing, there's also a lot of tradition involved in these types of things, should be paying the family of the deceased restitution, for taking the lives of the people that are there. But similar to Libya, Afghanistan itself is a very chaotic country, and a lot of the figures and statistics that the insurgents, the insurgent forces have killed more than the NATO. It's all very hard to actually believe
right.
those figures since the country is so large and the reporting is so bad. The United Nations does put out a report. Which I guess relatively speaking gives you kind of a little bit of an idea. And what they report is that in 2010, 2,777 civilians were killed. They report that 75% were killed by the Taliban, which, again, the United Nations is pretty much the occupying forces, so you can't look too much into it.
Yeah, it'd be hard to take that, right.
There was a 105% increase in targeted killings, an 83% rise in abductions. Then huge increases of nearly 600% and 300% in Helmand and Kandahar, which are the southern provinces next to the Pakistan border. And They reported a 26% decline in the number of civilian deaths caused by coalition Afghan forces. But to me, again, in all honesty, I don't really see how they're able to separate very clearly the certain deaths.
And as you pointed out, the fact is that these families where all the male members of the family are killed off, and there's no social safety net, and they're basically thrown on the mercy of relatives. It's actually worse than that, because women in these societies have virtually no rights at all.
And they probably can't get a good job and all that.
Oh,
right?
Forget it. Jobs
there's
are
no
hard, unavailable.
There, really.
Yeah, I mean, even the jobs that are available are hard to get, but for women it's just impossible.
Possible, right.
So basically, not to put too fine a point on it, we're not we, but the situation and the actions of both NATO and of the Taliban have put these women in a position where they're basically at risk of starvation.
Exactly.
There's no other way to put it. That's basically what it amounts to. And it makes me wonder just how many people are being lost, unreported in this manner.
The description of this thing is just, not to be a downer, but I have to read this. It says, the description of the event, a boy who was injured but survived described a helicopter gunship that hunted down the children as they gathered wood on the mountainside outside their village. The gunners apparently mistook the children for insurgents who only hours earlier had fired on a U.S. base. So they have to make, that's the problem. They're making a judgment call, and, they were gathering firewood, I guess completely innocent. But.
Yeah, absolutely a heartbreaking situation.
It is.
Right, and Karzai's cousin that was killed was reportedly between 60 and 65 years old, so that's also kind of an interesting deal. Again, the report itself is a little bit conflicting. There's part of the report says that he was murdered at home during a NATO raid. Another says that he's reported to have left the house at night carrying a weapon and then maybe was followed back or something like that, but... in some places like the southern part of Afghanistan, if you're not carrying around a weapon, I'd have to regard that as a little bit naive as well.
Risk adverse. You would think, I would think that weapons are common.
And of course, the overall question that kind of hangs over this whole picture is, what, at this point, is NATO's mission in Afghanistan?
Well, NATO itself doesn't even know what it is, but... The whole area, we've had all this violence and uprisings against the government, really a lot of times from people, just getting hungry and not having any jobs and getting tired of these governments really, destroying their country economically, either in some cases it might not even be on purpose because, a lot of folks don't quite understand the insidious policies that we have in the United States here of inflation and of the central banks and who really pays the price for these. And it's a lot of the poorest people on the planet. And when you're living on the line between starvation and that's your choice, you either starve or live, and people are becoming harder and harder, it's no wonder that we have a lot of things rising up. And it's going to be quite interesting to see because the United States still has 50,000, they say non-combat, but it's really 50,000 combat troops left in Iraq but are slated to leave by the end of this year really because Iraq wants them out of there. And I want our troops home as well, but on the flip side of things, with all this unrest in the Middle East, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out because countries like, for instance, Iran are going to be seeing that as a somewhat of a power vacuum developing, and who knows what's going to be happening in Saudi
that's
Arabia and Bahrain.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's a very good point because it shows that it isn't just a question of what happens when you intervene. It's also a question of what happens when the intervention ends.
A lot of times, the country is in way worse shape than it was when you started.
It often is true. In fact, I would say you're probably right.
Oh, yeah.
The majority of times.
Vietnam.
For sure.
Yeah.
Cambodia.
Very sad. And, of course, government intervention is not just an international thing as we move away from the absolutely depressing world of Afghanistan and the Middle East, but it also happens here at home. We were talking earlier about what's been going on with the mortgage mess, and all that, of course, is directly a result of both what the banking cartel and the federal government policies together have have mixed their brew to create this ugly mess. And Gene, you were talking about what's been happening with MERS. There is an article that came out this past week that is basically a tentative report about what the various federal agencies and state attorneys general are trying to do to help resolve the foreclosure practices problem. This report came out on March 3rd. It's a 27-page document to mortgage servicers that seeks a, quote, binding legal requirement, unquote, for how they service loans and conduct home foreclosures. That, according to Jeff Greenwood, a spokesman for Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, in a telephone interview, he said this is a document that sets a foundation for negotiations with the nation's largest servicers. He declined to identify the companies or say how many received a proposal, which was made by states and U.S. agencies, including the Justice Department, the Federal Trade Commission, and Department of Housing and Urban Development. The states and federal agencies haven't yet agreed on the monetary penalties they will seek from the companies, according to a person familiar with the matter. The government officials are also discussing a proposal for loan modification procedures, this person said. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Ally Financial said in their annual reports that they may have to pay fines and penalties, so obviously the speculation is that they're among the group that received the letter. And the payments were described as being material. I guess that means high. I'm not sure what that means.
I would think all payments are material. An illusion?
I think it's probably just another way of trying to downplay the whole thing. This isn't really all important. You know, nothing going on here, folks. Move along.
Let's just move on.
Yeah.
Just get back to business.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Sounds like a nationwide kind of way to, like, get through this thing or something, and, you know, so they can
Probably the most interesting thing is that there's no mention of MERS.
That is interesting, yeah.
Because that's the root of the whole crisis,
isn't
it? That's
the crux of it, right?
Yeah, and yet there's absolutely no mention of it whatsoever. So is this truly a real report? Is this truly a real action? Or is this just the first step in trying to cover the whole thing up?
Yeah. Well, until, you know, even these reports we've been uncovering, there's very few of them. And, you know, there's been a lot of action in the courts, you know, and it's not getting any... I haven't seen anything in the media for, you know, as far as TV or news reports for months. I mean, I don't know if that's a conscious thing or is they just kind of ignoring it or.
It's awful hard to know. I mean,
yeah, it's impossible to know.
Even what you get out of the news, I mean, I was reading from a Bloomberg article, and the end of the Bloomberg article says the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency separately sent cease and desist orders to mortgage servicers, according to a person familiar with the matter. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Citigroup are among the eight national banks that are expected to get an enforcement document of some kind. Now, what are these cease and desist orders about? Who knows? The article doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
And this is one of the more detailed articles out there.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
That's why I say it certainly seems like a veil is being pulled. I mean, that's my impression.
When you consider the root of the problem, MERS, the fact that they didn't record these things or they recorded it in their computer or whatever they did, it wasn't the kosher method of recording it, and that states have, you know, stood up and said this isn't going to work. And you still, like you said, they don't mention MERS. I mean, what are they talking about if they're not talking about the title? I mean, it's all about the title. I mean, title, our entire economy is based on private property, and that's all the title is. And they circumvented it because it was profitable, and now they're, like you say, they seem to be just ignoring, you know, confronting that issue.
I did see one article, though, that I do want to share that did not ignore, right? And it's an interesting one because it addresses one of our favorite politicians, Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, and it's written by someone who works for the Federal Reserve. The gentleman's name is David Andolfato. Is that guy's name right? Andolfato, I think is the pronunciation of his name. And he's basically written a column, an article that he calls Ron Paul's Money Illusion. Let me read it to you. He says, I can appreciate Ron Paul's libertarian philosophy, and because this is so, it pains me all the more to say what I'm about to say. The guy can be a real pinhead at times, he writes. And this is never so evident as his persistent attacks against the Fed. Now, of course, I work at the Fed, so maybe you think I'm just complaining for the sake of defending my employer. If you think that, I can understand why you do. It is because you do not know me. There are legitimate arguments one could make against the Fed as an institution and or about the conduct of Fed policy. And then there are the stupid arguments, he says. For example, the one contained on page 25 of Congressman Paul's book, End the Fed. He quotes,
One only needs to reflect on the dramatic decline in the value of the dollar that has taken place since the Fed was established in 1913. The goods and services you could buy for $1 in 1913 now cost nearly $21. Another way to look at this is from the perspective of the purchasing power of the dollar itself. It has fallen to less than 5 cents of its 1913 value. We might say that the government and its banking cartel have together stolen 95 cents of every dollar as they have pursued a relentlessly inflationary policy. So now the columnist goes on to say, one might indeed say that, Mr. Congressman, but if one did, one would be behaving like an opportunistic politician, which I know you are not. Now, he says, let us examine what is wrong or misleading in this statement above. First, he says, with the exception of the last sentence, there is nothing factually incorrect. Indeed, the data sourced cited by Paula is, ironically enough, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, which is the very same branch of the Federal Reserve that this particular gentleman works for. I think that's probably no coincidence. So the question is not whether he has his facts straight. The question is whether those facts matter, he says. He says there is an old idea in monetary theory called money neutrality. Money neutrality means that larger quantities of money ultimately manifest themselves in the form of higher nominal prices and wages, and not on real quantities. No serious economist disputes the idea of long-run money neutrality. Yes, what cost $1 in 1913 now costs $20, he says, but so what? Money neutrality states that if you were earning $1 per hour in 1913, you are now earning $20 per hour, or even more if labor productivity is high. So there you go, he says. The Fed is responsible for increasing your nominal wage by a factor of 20. How do you, all you workers out there like them apples? Ron Paul wants to rob you of these wage increases. And he goes on basically along those same lines. What he doesn't address, and this is the part that I thought was really interesting, he refers to this as Congressman Paul's money illusion, but he fails to neglect, he completely neglects to address the fact that anyone who saves money during that period of time gets robbed blind. The only thing he addresses is how wages overall on average have increased. He also fails to address the fact that, you know, the average wage earner doesn't just get an automatic wage increase each year. He starts off at a particular wage and he stays there for a while until he either changes jobs or, if he's really lucky, he gets a raise. But most often, the only way he's going to get better money is if he changes jobs. And that's only if he's in an industry where there's demand for what he's doing. If he's in an industry where there's not so much demand, his wage isn't going up at all. So there's two big ways that Mr. Adam, I'm not going to try and pronounce his last name, Mr. Federal Reserve is completely off the mark when he's criticizing Congressman Paul. Not only is he completely ignoring what happens to anyone who saves money, he's also ignoring what happens to people whose wages don't increase on a year-to-year basis. And I also want to clarify something. One of the things that really bugs me about the way most economists handle the word savings is they imply that savings is what you put into a bank account. And I want to clarify, that's not what savings is. That's investment. It's a very bad form of investment. It's a form of investment where you'll still lose against inflation, but it is a form of investment. Savings is where you put money aside. That's savings.
Storage, right?
That's right. You store it. If you store money under our current debt-based monetary system that Mr. Fed is so easily defending, you're going to get totally wiped out.
The other thing is, I've read that in the last 30 years, wages have fallen like crazy against, considering the inflation of wages against the inflation of goods, that they've fallen in the last 30 years. So.
And that's true. Actually, there was a gain over the first 40 years or so after the Fed went into existence, whereby if you can call this a gain, wages advanced faster than inflation did. But that started to change around the 1950s, and since then it's been going in the opposite direction. So even there, it shows just how badly Mr. Fed misses on his argument.
The other thing that's never mentioned is productivity and increasing efficiency of production should have a deflationary effect, and we're constantly doing it. And industries get more and more efficient. And so actually, if an inflation rate is 2%, I mean, what is the influence of the efficiency factor? You know, if you, let's say you take away inflation completely, you would actually have maybe a 3% deflation rate with the efficiency. But we don't see that at all. All we see is inflation. So it's actually higher than, you know, even the lowest statistics if you consider the efficiency of production. Does that make sense?
Absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Well, we're running out of time here, but we've got about a minute and a half, something like that, left. And I wanted to touch on one more thing that you had brought to the table, Gene. You had, I believe, an interesting little thing about anti-unionism, and I presume that relates to what's been going on in Wisconsin. Can you touch on it in about 30 seconds to a minute?
I'll try. This is really interesting. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio made a statement. He said, I look back at history and some of the worst governments we've ever had were anti-union. And he got a lot of flack for it. So this is from Political Fact, which is they check the facts. And what they found out is that that's actually true. The Nazis, Russia, even Mubarak were all anti-union. And they stated that he actually was, you know, his statement was true, even though he got a lot of flack saying, you know, you're connecting Hitler.
Well, of course, we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. So let's pick it up next week, and we'll ask you to join us all here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Stay free, everyone.
See you later.
Say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we don't love to see the plan. Ask me for a contribution.